Welcome to the Westwood Church Podcast. I'm Molly Vetter, the senior pastor at Westwood. I'm glad you've chosen to listen in to this sermon from our sanctuary. Please know, you're always welcome to join us in person on Sunday mornings at 10. Our sanctuary is a sacred, stained glass lit space. There, prayers, pipe organ, and choir mark sacred time when we get to refocus our lives around the gift of God's radical, inclusive love. We're a church committed to justice, kindness, and walking humbly with God. So thank you for listening in today. We encourage you to share and subscribe to the podcast, and also invite you to follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Most of all, we encourage you to join us in the living out of our faith for the sake of God's love. I also am aware, as I'm preparing to go to this retreat in Alabama this week, that I treasure the opportunity to be together with a community of people who check in with me and give me occasion to check in with myself about my spiritual life. We Methodists got our derisive nickname Methodist because of the methods and practices that the early leaders of our particular strain of Christianity gave to themselves, figured out for themselves to help them live richer spiritual lives in service of God and neighbor. So I thought I'd start this morning with a little spiritual check-in. You might have encountered this before in the Methodist tradition of gathering in small groups and asking ourselves, how is it with my soul? And giving account of that. You might have encountered this as a practice that St. Ignatius of Loyola gave to people. He called it the examine, an opportunity to sort of examine your life. So I invite you to take just a minute and to think back over this last week and say, what were my high points? Where did I feel fully alive? And what were the low points? Where did I feel as if life was disappearing from me? What were my life-giving moments and my life-draining moments? And as a bonus, if you can notice God's presence anywhere, that's the challenge question. So just take a minute and reflect back over your week. Think about where you felt fully alive and where you felt as if life was being drained from you, disappearing from you, the low moments in your week and any presence of God. I'll give you 10 seconds to think deep thoughts. That's ample time, right? And then I invite you to turn to a neighbor and share with him a brief account, as deep as you're willing to go, with whoever's seated near you. Make sure you know their name. And then speak and listen to each other about where we've felt fully alive and where we've felt life draining away. I invite you to hold silence with me for just a moment. And as you're ready and able, will you share with your neighbor? I'll give you a minute and a half. At 45 seconds, I'll say switch, which means if you've been talking, you should start listening. Go. Switch. thank you for taking a moment to share. I'm grateful for your bringing yourself to this place this morning. I think I was hungry for a spiritual check-in, or am hungry for a spiritual check-in, because this week has just seemed to go on forever. In fact, January feels like it's gone on forever in my world. Someone said Happy New Year to me last week, and I was like, is it still the new year? It feels like 2020 has been like lifetimes full already in this moment. I know that some of it's personal. I'm aware that I've been your pastor here now for more than 6 months, which means that the sort of the giddy excitement of just meeting you is, well, it's not waning, but it's changing. It's changing. And I'm feeling like I'm only getting a longer list of more questions that I have to ask, right? Like I thought I would have it all figured out by January, but I feel like I just now have a much longer list of questions to answer and things to wrestle with. I'm aware that I have to like recalibrate my sense of being with you in community, because I hope this is going to last a while. And, you know, it's month eight now, technically, right? We're starting is this February? We made it, right? It's been a heavy week in the midst of our world, as fears of a coronavirus spread, as the reality of the flu in our own families and communities and world, as the winter sickness not only takes hold as usual, but comes with increasing threat. And when that threat gets mapped upon the sort of geopolitical realities, it only makes me more depressed. Our fear of others seems to exponentially increase. The practicalities of protecting ourselves from infection makes us take up postures that may be effective for preventing the spread of disease, but are problematic for our long-term engagement with each other as community, right? I mean, it makes us anxious to shake hands in church, or thankfully Andrew brought hand sanitizer, so I was able to shake hands with abandon and know that I could be disinfected. It changes our perspective and engagement with the world. And this has been a heavy week for Los Angeles. If you know me, you know that I'm not a sports ball person. I'm told that there's a big game happening this afternoon, but it's not the game that Kobe Bryant played. There's a church softball team, which is yet a third sports ball. Anyway, I'm not a sports ball person, but I have to say I was deeply affected by the helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant this week. I'm so not a sports ball person, a basketball person, that I never engaged with him as a hero of the sport. And I know some of you did. Some of you are fans of basketball who follow the NBA, who take your middle school children to games on weekends, who are pursuing this as a personal and family passion. My relationship to Kobe was different. I'm sort of embarrassed to admit this, but I've always felt like I had a special relationship to Kobe Bryant. This seems weird, but I came to California just a couple of years after he did, as an anomaly of a young person headed into ordained ministry. I was younger than most of my peers when I became a pastor, and something about Kobe Bryant making it on the Lakers made it slightly more possible for me to be a 24-year-old pastor assigned to pastor a congregation. And in every setting where groups of church folk that were much older than me gathered, and by their body postures and sometimes their words and their attitudes and my own insecurities made me feel as if I weren't legitimate there, something about Kobe being great on the Lakers made just a little more space for my believing that it were possible, that it's real, that I'm was doing the thing that I was doing. And I related to him as someone who excelled at his work. But I have to say, even more than when he was playing basketball, I felt connection to him in the time after his retirement, where it seemed that he made an amazing and beautiful gradual transition of his priorities and his sensibilities, of his responsibility to his family. And so that I found a special delight in watching him become a what had seemed unlikely 20 years earlier, an advocate who by his parenting decisions was advocating and making space for women's sports to be taken seriously on the same sort of stage as men's sports, who by his family life, married to a Latina and raising biracial children, was able to witness to the dignity, the value, the beauty of diversity, and the quickness with which he moved from English to Spanish was something that was hopeful. He embodied a kind of hopefulness that was meaningful to me, that seemed to be in contrast, or at least in expanding what he was initially known for, to become like a real person, a whole person. And the reminder that he, like the rest of us, is mortal came as a sudden shock that has occupied more of my emotions this week than I would have ever expected, confessing that I'm not someone who's that much paid attention to basketball. If anything, I then was ready to hear the words that Jesus spoke in the Sermon on the Mount as he, against evidence to the contrary, proclaimed the blessedness of the broken, of the poor in spirit, and of those who mourn. As he spoke into the world a vision of hope, a declaration of God's presence with those who have been broken. And I need it now more than ever, not only because of that grief, because of the reality of our human mortality and fragility, but because things seem desperate and strained in our national politics and through the world, as institutions that I thought I could count on seem incapable of even hosting well-rounded conversation. It seems impossible to genuinely explore questions because of polarization and division, struggling over power, and not opening up a forum where we could be the complicated people we are, exploring the difficult conversation about what has us, what holds us together as a nation. The front page of the Los Angeles Times this morning focuses us in on Iowa, which has been the center of political attention in preparation for the Iowa primaries. But the front page article this morning is exploring the deep racism of one particular small town in Iowa that has struggled to overcome racism against African American residents in that community. It's a window into the reality that the present struggles we see aren't just of this moment, but that they're deeply embedded in who we are and how we've become the country that we are. They, kind of like my January, make me realize that this isn't a problem we're going to solve quickly or easily, that it's going to require asking more difficult questions and digging more deeply in to understand how it is that we've come to see as individuals, as groups of people, that somehow our success requires the keeping down, the keeping out, the marginalizing of someone else. This tendency of humans aware of our mortality and perceiving a threat, this tendency of isolation, of seeking our own individual gain, is dangerous to the gospel. Or put the other way, the gospel is dangerous to this way of thinking of ourselves, of believing that somehow we can prosper on the backs of someone else. The gospel flips everything over. It inverts our perception of the world. It's like a magic lens that literally flips everything up on its head and invites us to perceive something different happening even now. It's continuous with the way that God has moved from the beginning of time. It's continuous with the words that the prophet Micah offered to the people who were wanting to give praise back to God. Well, the prophet starts with this declaration of how God has been saving people from the beginning of time, and then counters the weird human idea that somehow we repay God, that we give blessing back to God through bizarre sacrifices, rivers of oil, even our firstborn. In the prophet Micah's words, God speaks clearly, here's what I want, not your weird offering of sacrifice. Here's what I want. I want you to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with God. The prophet Micah articulates so clearly this basic rule for how it is we're called to live, what we're invited to live for, that we might turn back to for a reminder of the goals of our being in relationship with God and each other. Our basic rule, our MO, is to do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with God. Sometimes it seems like the world makes that easy, but more often it feels like the values of the world, the values of our community, the fears in our own human hearts make that work difficult. And so periodically, as the prophet Micah did for the people of Israel, as Jesus does on the Sermon on the Mount, we need to be shaken up. Kobe and I were roughly the same age. I shouldn't say like I'm older, but there you have it. I have to believe that he also heard some of the same music I heard growing up. I think of, REM was one of the bands that I played on repeat during my high school years. They sang over and over in hope-filled, cheery tones, "It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine," which I think gave me confidence to believe in the ending of one way of being in the world and the opening up of a new possibility. In the acceptance that Jesus really meant it when he declared the blessing in those who appear to be suffering and struggling, to be pushed to the edges. The English word that we use to describe what Jesus spoke, probably originally in Aramaic and then was captured in Greek, this word of blessing has sometimes been translated happy are. Is that how you learned it in your child? Happy are the... Sharon's shaking her head. That is not helpful. In the New Revised Standard Version, we get blessed. Blessed are the, which I think is more helpful. I read a commentary this week that suggested we might not say blessed are the, but enviable are the, which I think speaks even a little more radically, and I like this idea. Enviable are the poor in spirit because theirs is this new reality that God is giving to us. Blessed, enviable are those who are mourning, because they're going to really be comforted. It reminded me of a moment early in my pastoral life. I was assigned to pastoral care in a large congregation, and I often felt poorly prepared, you know, as a 25-year-old, to give pastoral care for the range of life experiences that people brought to church. I remember a vivid conversation on a bench outside of a hospice facility with a woman who was then probably in her mid-50s, who was preparing to say her final goodbye to her husband. With teenage children at home, she was struggling with that deep and sharp grief of an illness that had come quickly and in the space of a year was going to have taken away her husband and partner in life. As we sat on that park bench at that hospice facility and spoke, she said something strange to me that was difficult to believe, but that echoed the message of the gospel. She said, "I feel uncomfortable even speaking this out loud because I don't want to in any way imply that I have any gratitude for what's happening to my husband. But one of the strange gifts of this time in my life," she said, "is that I've discovered there's a whole community of people who care about me and want me to be well." She said, "It hadn't been visible to me before. I felt more alone. It was just she and her husband trying to make it out against the world." And somehow, in the midst of grief, in the midst of her need, opened up a new space that allowed her to perceive herself belonging in a much bigger community of life, a community of care. I think this is more than just a silver lining in a gray cloud. I think this is the way the gospel works, is that it moves into the broken spaces, the cracks and the hurts, and the gospel does a new thing. It does a work of redemption that opens up a space for life where it had seemed to be impossible. I think it's a piece of why we come to the communion table in our worship, because the bread breaks open, and somehow in that broken open bread that reminds us of the broken body of Jesus Christ, we find life. And we discover that we are not so alone in this work. And we discover that it was never about us making it on our own. It was never about us making it over other people, but it was about us finding our place in the broken open body that is the church, that is the community, that is the very body of Christ. As we somehow, against our training and against what seems logical, find enviable the gift of God's presence in our broken world. Be jealous, Jesus says. Be jealous of the poor in spirit, because they've got it going on. They don't anymore pretend that it was about them having to succeed in order to be worthy. Blessed are the mourners, because they were never deceived to believing that they were left all alone. They always had the comfort of community to cry with them. In the midst of the broken open, the broken apart, the dividing world, Jesus speaks this declaration of new life. And so, since this text is literally called, in our English rendering of titles in Bibles, the Sermon on the Mount, it seemed to me I should end this morning with Jesus' sermon. It's a confession that I feel a little inadequate to preach a brilliant sermon on a sermon. So I'll end with these words. I invite you to hear them, to let them do their work in you, that those radical words Jesus spoke on a mountain 2,000 years ago might speak life and blessing into you, into us, into this world today. Jesus began to speak. He taught the people, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Thanks be to God for this word.